to the Introvert Entrepreneur Podcast for February 4th, 2013. I'm Beth Below, your go-to resource for all things introvert. The Introvert Entrepreneur was founded in 2010 and is dedicated to providing services to introverts and those who love them. This past Friday, February 1st, was a special day for introverts everywhere. It marked the release of the second edition of Laurie Helgo's fabulous book, Introvert Power, Why Your Inner Life is Your Hidden Strength. It's chock full of stories, research, and quotes from introverts the world over, all affirming the quieter gifts of being an introvert. And this new edition reveals even more insights that are sure to have readers nodding their heads in agreement and feeling a connection to introverts everywhere. It's an honor to interview Laurie for this podcast and chat a little bit more about her book. Dr. Laurie Helgo is an author and clinical psychologist specializing in personality and the psychology of desire. As owner of Book It Literary Consulting, she enjoys helping writers prepare their books for publication. Helgo authored the cover story, Revenge of the Introverts, for the September-October 2010 issue of Psychology Today. She has been profiled or quoted in more than 40 publications, including The Wall Street Journal, Real Simple Family, Body and Soul Magazine, Esquire.com, WashingtonPost.com, and Psychology Today. Helgo's books include Introvert Power, recipient of a Publisher's Weekly Starred Review, The Complete Idiot's Guide to Raising Boys, The Anxiety Answer Book, The Boomer's Guide to Dating Again, and The Pocket Idiot's Guide to Breaking Up. Hi, Laurie. Congratulations on the publication of the second edition of Introvert Power. That is so exciting, and I'm so glad you're going to be talking with us today.
Well, thank you, Beth, and I'm so happy to be here.
Well, what is making you smile inside today?
Well, today I'm looking at a copy of my second edition of Introvert Power, and I'm smiling inside because I am feeling very lucky that I have had this opportunity to communicate in the best possible way an introvert gets to communicate, which is to give the intimacy of my thoughts and in the way that I want to express them, over time with elaboration and clarification and then to be able to build on what I had out there in the first edition and show the ways I've grown up even more since then or in some ways for the first time passing new developmental phases. And so I just feel so lucky to keep this dialogue alive in a way that introverts like to do it.
Yeah, because the first edition was in 2008. Is that
That's right.
Correct? Yeah, so some time has passed, and I know that you personally have, like you said, been through some changes and stuff, and this was a great chance to share some of that. Tell us a little bit about what is new in this edition.
Okay, well, one thing that is new is I alluded to some new developmental phases of experiencing the empty nest, and probably the only thing that I would take back from the first edition, just that I didn't really know yet, was what that experience would be like for me. But my nest emptied of my our sons, but also for a good couple years of my husband, who was working in Afghanistan. So here I am, an introvert, having large doses of solitude and experiencing what that meant. And then the other, probably the centerpiece of the second edition, came out of the findings that keep popping up that show this link between extroversion and happiness, which seemed a bit troubling and seemed to also fuel this idea that introverts have a problem and even perhaps need diagnosing. The word introversion was in the DSM-5 proposed edition in a number of places. And this was troubling to me and didn't fit my own experience. And when I started looking between the lines, there was so much to elaborate on and to understand that gives a more accurate picture, that I added a new chapter called the Get Happier Mandate. And what I found in writing that is that what we talk about in our culture as happiness is often is really kind of a revved up version of happiness. It's a high energy, scientists call it a high arousal positive affect. It's a feeling, it's transient, it's not quality of life. It's not so many things. And what it also is not is a whole set of positive emotions that are of a calmer variety, expressed by words like serene, calm, tranquil, relaxed. We don't talk about those feelings so much in our pursuit of happiness discussions. Even the pursuit idea is something that I question in the book, and I'm not the only one who's questioning it. What I found very fascinating is to know that these low arousal positive feelings are more valued than the high arousal ones in other societies, such as China, Japan, more collectivistic cultures, and that you have, depending upon how you match up with your society, will determine a little bit about how you feel about yourself. So we take an extrovert in our society is going to feel better about him or herself than the extrovert in one of these collectivistic societies. And so it's really important for us to start to look at the ways we narrow experience and narrow our definition of what's healthy and what is happy.
There's not just one. Happiness doesn't look like one particular thing and everything else is wrong, or, oh, you're not smiling, you must be depressed.
Yes,
I think introverts tend to get that a lot. And you know, at the worst end, it might be, what's wrong with you? Are you depressed? And in other ways, we can just appear aloof or standoffish or disinterested when really we're just calm, observing, we're fine, happy even.
Yeah. Right, smiling inside, yes, exactly. And yeah, when I was looking through all these studies, I got this song in my head, this Put on a Happy Face, and I looked up the lyrics. It's from the 60s musical Bye Bye Birdie, and there's a line, wipe off that full of doubt look, slap on a happy grin. And I realized this full of doubt look is a very, it's probably my signature introvert look. It's the look that puzzles my husband. He wants to know what's going on. Or it was captured by my sister in a painting she did of me. But it's doesn't mean I'm depressed. It's the look I give when I'm thinking about something. I'm listening intently. And it's a look that says there's something going on inside. You may not know what it is, but don't assume that it's an absence of something desirable.
That's a great way of putting it. And it seems like that connects to what probably contributed to the DSM, the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual.
Right, exactly.
That things were measured on a scale of extroversion, and the appearance of extroversion or the lack of extroversion, as opposed to introversion being, or part of the spectrum, I should say.
Yes, yes, that's a huge problem, because if we look at extroversion as the thing and introversion as the lack of the thing, you know, we talk about extroversion, we'll use words like energetic or outgoing, and in some measures they'll use kind of the negative of that. So an introvert would be described as lethargic, and in one study that was the case. It was a word like lethargic and unadventurous were words that apparently were there supposedly to describe introverts, but they don't describe anything. They just describe they describe non-extroversion. And so that if you use a word like reflective, you know, then there's a something there, and it makes a huge difference.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's one thing that I think I've noticed. The language shifting, there's a little bit more empowerment to the introvert characteristics and strengths, and it's being talked about much more in terms of what we have rather than what we lack. And that's powerful for our own self-acceptance and our self-esteem.
Right. And if you look at brain scans, you know that in response to stimulation, there's more activity in an introvert brain than an extrovert brain. So there's clearly something happening.
Yep. The lights are on and somebody is home.
That's right.
Exactly. I'm curious to circle back to what you mentioned about your husband and that time you had alone. I'm wondering what your experience was and what you learned.
Yeah. Well, I was surprised how scared I was of it, actually. And I think introverts will say this, that as much as we crave solitude, it's like the good china that we save for a special occasion. We give ourselves little doses of it. But to immerse ourselves is a little scary. And of course, I was frightened by the prospect of him being in a war zone. But I had to admit to myself that part of a big part of my fear was what was it going to be like to be without this person who I've been with for, close to 30 years. And it was a eye-opener. I learned a lot because on the one hand, I faced loneliness and I faced that longing to have that comfortable person with me. And for introverts, the thing about not having the comfortable person with you, the person you don't have to talk to all the time, is that can be even harder because we don't interchange people as easily. And I don't think extroverts do either, really. But I think that if for introverts, we're not going to automatically seek to fill that space. And I think that's also an introvert strength. And that's something I found, too, when I was in these solitary times that were harder, is that I felt pretty selective about whom I might connect with in those times. And I found myself connecting with female introverts, like a neighbor of mine who had lost a husband and also just was comfortable hanging out. And I did have my crying sessions in her screened-in porch. And she just was able to be that presence with me. But I learned that, the fact that we are friendly with solitude, even when it's hard, to me, struck me as a particular strength of introverts. I also learned, though, that, there's a lot of wonderful poetry about solitude, but sometimes solitude sucks, and sometimes it's not this rich, wonderful space. I think we can, get into small talk when we're in social situations. We can get into small thoughts sometimes when we're alone, And so I found that it's very important to feed our solitude and nourish it with, being selective about what we watch and what we, read and take in into that space.
Thank you for sharing that, because that's an experience that I don't think we would know how we would respond to it until we were in it.
Right.
And so it's wonderful that you were able to share that in the book as part of the new material. One chapter that really resonated with me that's a carryover from the first edition is called Becoming an Alien. And you have a really wonderful and brilliant way of describing the way that the relationship that introverts have with society and then society with introverts. And you talk about shadow dwellers, accessible introverts, and the third option. Can you tell us more about those kind of different introvert identities?
What I talk about is what happens when the introvert feels a clash with society. Society says, be this way, get out there, be more outgoing. And the introvert feels this conflict. Okay, so what do I do? Do I, one, just pull away from society, or two, conform? And so there are the first two options I talk about are ways that we go one way or the other with that. The the pulling away and or even accepting some of the negative stereotypes of introverts might result in more that shadow dweller identity. And the nice thing for shadow dwellers is that they do kind of get to hang in the shadows and don't get as much stimulation in terms of being treated like extroverts. And I talk about the goth subculture as just a very nice example of a subculture that just says, okay, we're going to just put this out there, you know, this kind of darkness and deal with it kind of thing. And, you know, and rather than feeling like they have to, you know, engage around that, just put it out there and be a little freer. And sometimes I kind of envy that orientation. And there are just many, many subcultures that have that kind of shadowy kind of extra societal identity, some, you know, extraterrestrial maybe even, depending upon the group. You know, and artists maybe who wear black and really, you know, carry around a dour expression might kind of enjoy, yeah, you know, this is kind of nice, I get off the hook. So there are some positives, certainly, and then the very positive end, you know, can be an activism that comes with that. Like Lady Gaga, not necessarily introvert, but does kind of like, you know, let's embrace the monster identity kind of thing. So there's really a very, there can be a lot of power in that. But the downside is the alienation that a person can feel, and the person really is not that different than the rest of us and can become kind of a parody of something. The other way of adapting or dealing with the pressure is to take on more extroverted characteristics, to be very, I call it the accessible introvert, as opposed to the shadow dweller. And I would be in more in that category in terms of the way I adapted. Pastor's kid from a family of 10 and had to smile and interact a lot, and I was able to do that. And again, there are advantages with that because I learned to be engaging and make other people feel comfortable. The downside is I can make other people feel so comfortable that they talk my ear off and don't really know me in my truest sense. So the third option I talk about is being more openly introverted and carrying around a different perception of society in a way, because it's true, it's not true, this perception that we've been taught that we're an extroverted society. It's not really true because half of us are introverts. And we do have some of those, you know, we're a competitive society. We do have some of those qualities in our social system that parallel extroversion. But I think when we start seeing and connecting and considering introversion in the fabric of our lives, and I think so often we can actually treat other introverts in the same way that we don't want to be treated, worrying that somebody who isn't smiling is depressed, or, you know, assuming a worrying if somebody decides they want to stay home on a Friday night when that's exactly what we want to do too. So, you know, so making those connections and it's a subtle but incredibly powerful shift to say, yeah, I belong here, and this is as much an introverted place as an extroverted place.
And what you said about the accessible introverts, when I was reading about that, of course, I identified with that as well, in terms of adapting certain traits and behaviors and skills that help us kind of fit in. And it's interesting because on my Facebook page, there's been a lot of conversation recently about fitting in or not fitting in, and especially about that piece where you mentioned, well, if I'm too much of an accessible introvert, I end up getting people who are talking way too much, like I'm too open and too accessible, right. And that can drain my energy. So I want to follow up on one of your chapters that's called The Conversation Conundrum. Today I posted a picture on Facebook that's actually a Currier and Ives lithograph from around 1873. This shows a man being carted away on a stretcher with a caption, "This man was talked to death." And I just thought that was so funny. I thought, yeah, well, this has been going on for a very long time, even back in the Victorian age. And one of my Facebook users asked a question. Her name is Marie. And she said, any great ideas on how to stop the talking without being rude? And especially, what if it's a person that you love and care about and that you want to continue the friendship, yet the energy of their talking is too much? How right. do you handle that?
Great question. And it's, I think that I'll take the two pieces to it separately, because first, the question about how do you stop it without being rude, that's a bit of a paradox. And it depends on the person. But if we're talking about extreme, what I call extreme talkers, others have called exhausters, there may not be a way to stop it without being what we consider rude. But I ask introverts to shift their thinking about rude just a little bit, because as the man on the stretcher, I actually think that being talked to can do harm. And I have experienced migraines in response to a level of talk and intensity that is just oppressive. You know, but I think we can do some things. We can, first of all, be more accurate with our nonverbal feedback. And I'm guilty of doing the nodding and ahas, which for extroverts can be taken as a cue to keep talking. And even my little sister, who I'm very close to, that it wasn't until, you know, you wrote your book that I realized when you're quiet, it doesn't necessarily mean you want me to keep talking. And it floored me, because, you know, I felt like we'd had conversations about our conversations. You know, we've gotten into things before, but she hadn't really comprehended that. Because for an extrovert, if they want to talk, they'll talk. If they have something in their heads, you know, that they, whether it's fully formed or not, a lot of times extroverts like to put it out there before it's fully formed. And we're in there kind of working it out. So I think we can be more accurate with our nonverbal cues by, you know, furrowing the brow, looking up and away, indicating we're thinking about it, which of course they might think we're bored, which may be also true. And sometimes it's okay to give those cues, but really trying to give those cues. Now, extreme talker isn't going to care. It isn't going to pick up on that. And not all extroverts, thankfully, are extreme talkers. The other thing we can do, though, if the nonverbals aren't getting the message across, is to actually give some verbal evidence that we're thinking and need a pause. Say, hey, wait a minute, slow down, you know. I'm thinking about what you just said, and I'm also thinking about my response to that, and you're gonna lose me if you keep going. And it's just a marker, just a kind of a hold on. You don't have to necessarily even give any feedback at that point, except that about your process. And I often talk about the experience of going for a walk with my older sister. I was embedded between two extroverted sisters, so I got some good training in how to, you know, skirt these things. But I, at some point I stopped her and said, now wait, you're five thoughts ahead of me. Because she didn't realize I was kind of deep processing everything she was telling me, and I was starting to feel the strain of it. And that's a point where I would have, if I hadn't said that, I would have started checking out, which is an unkind thing to do if we're close to somebody. And even though we may feel it's rude to stop somebody, it's actually probably more rude, you know, go off, you know, and tune them out. So, and then at the extreme, you know, if somebody just doesn't get it and they're talking in an abusive kind of way, abusive of your mind and your attention, then you got to stop thinking of yourself as being the rude one. You're being the victim of rudeness, and it's time to protect yourself and say, you know what, I got to go. And then just cut it off. And they may still keep talking as you're walking away.
That's funny.
Unfortunately, those are only extreme situations. But yeah. And the other thing I say with loved ones is to have conversations outside of the conversation. You know, like, because it may be hard to, you know, we always think of things later. We'll give ourselves a second chance. If we think of it later, say, you know what, I feel like, you know, you didn't really know where I was in that last conversation. I just want to tell you a little bit about the way my head works. And that can be a nice low pressure way to talk about how you talk.
Yeah, and to maybe talk about it outside of the conversation where it's happening, perhaps.
Yeah.
Is that what I'm hearing? Like kind of separate the two experiences?
Exactly.
It seems like that's the loving and respectful thing to do, and that the person would be grateful to know, if it's a good relationship, I should say,
exactly.
They would probably be grateful to know what's going to make it more mutually satisfying.
Right. My husband is a good example of that. If he asks me a question and I'm silent, he now knows. He'll say, oh, you're thinking about it, right? You need a little time to think about it. But he can take that as a sign that I'm not interested in his question, or I'm not responding. And so our talking about that, his knowing now the way my mind works, he'll remind himself kind of verbally, okay, you're thinking about it, right? And I'm like, yes, thanks.
What you're sharing is a great reminder that we introverts have to remember that other people aren't mind readers, and that we might not feel like we need to tell them, because it should be obvious by the look on my face or my body language or something, that, you know, sometimes a little transparency and over communication can go a long way.
And to be fair, sometimes with, you know, an extrovert is more comfortable with interruptions. We do not like to interrupt or be interrupted. And sometimes we have to hit some compromises with that, where we just need to interrupt if we're going to be a part of the conversation. And if it's a relationship we value, we'll work those compromises. If it's not, it may not be, you know, worth our time.
Well, it's clear from this conversation and from your book that you seem to love being an introvert. Like, you wouldn't have it any other way. Is that true?
I would say for the large most part of my world and my life, I like all of us, you know, have my moments. But introvert is so much a part of what I do love about being me. So yes, I'll say yes.
Okay. Yeah. I realized as I said that, I thought that might not be true, but I'll just put it out there anyway, and she can tell me I'm wrong.
And one of the wonderful things about introverts is that we turn things over and question things. So part of what I question sometimes is who I am and how I do things. That's a bit of a paradox.
Well, what do you, when you are appreciating being an introvert, what do you appreciate most?
I love that I can find respite within myself. And there's just something about that experience of being cozy with myself, of coming home from an event and getting to be with me. And I think you and I were talking in another conversation about that sometimes it's worth going out just to have that experience of
yes.
to ourselves.
Exactly. You
know, and yes, and I do love that. And I like that my mind wants to make stories and observe. When I travel, I love the experience of being a flaneur, which we don't really have an adequate translation for, but a passionate observer, somebody who can be in the midst of things and not a part of them, but observe and just take in the energy of the surroundings in a quieter way. So all those things, you know, just being one step removed can be just a wonderful place to be.
Well, the way you open up the book, I had to tell my husband about it on Friday night because we went out to dinner at a Indian restaurant, and it was, you know, 7 o'clock on a Friday night. So it was pretty crowded, and we didn't have reservations. So we sat at this rather small table, very close to another couple. And I could tell that my husband was uncomfortable. He's a fellow introvert, and I could tell he was like, the noise level, the stimulation, it's a little too much to relax. And I said, well, we can think of it this way. You know what a mosh pit is? Well, he was born in 1961, so yes, he definitely knows what a mosh pit is. And so I told him about meditating in the mosh pit. And he was like, oh, I really like that. And it really shifted the way we were able to be in the space when we decided, okay, we're going to be sort of observers here. And we're going to let the energy be around us, but not necessarily absorb it to where it interferes with our enjoyment of our evening.
Oh, I love that. I love that. Yeah, I just, that for me really captures the, you know, that paradox, and there is something just marvelous about making that shift, meditating in the mosh pit. That's great.
The food tasted that much better because we were able to just sort of let it go, you know, release being stressed about it. Just saying, it is what it is. So to wrap up, I want to ask you a question I've asked all of my guests, and you've been one of my guests before, but it's been a couple of years, so I'm guessing your answer has changed. But if you were granted a year's vacation on Introvert Island, and you could only take 3 books with you, and this is the old-fashioned kind, not the Kindle or Nook.
Good.
Yes, we loved our paper and our visceral experience. So which 3 would you take with you and why?
Well, I love and hate this question. Three, it's hard to decide. And yet the idea of being able to have these treasured books and all this time is wonderful. I would definitely take a collection of poetry. Poetry is so wonderfully compact, and yet it carries so much life and energy and material for an introvert to muse on. So a couple I like, one is Garrison Keillor's Good Poems, his collection. And then more recently, I've fallen in love with a book called, it's an old one that I had on my shelf, 1,000 Beautiful Things, edited by Marjorie Barrows. And that also has little short stories and quotes, and as well as poetry. So there would be, I'd have to choose between those. And then I think one that I mentioned before, and it's Henry David Thoreau's Walden, I'm not quite finished with my assignment because I have these finalists. But.
Yeah, you've narrowed it down to maybe 5. And
Or Walt Whitman's Leaves of Grass. But what I love about both of those is that there's just something about being able to connect with another solitary soul in that person's experience. And here I'd be on Introvert Island, and yet I'd be able to connect with Thoreau, you know, at Walden Pond and feel this kinship. So I think I would like to have one of those books. And then just to have something very different, I love Oscar Wilde, and particularly The Picture of Dorian Gray, which, of course, you know, a lot of people think of it as a kind of a horror story, but I think of it more for its witty dialogue and even comedic aspects, and it's very theatrical, and I would see myself perhaps memorizing and even play acting some of that dialogue and having fun with that.
I've noticed I don't know that Oscar Wilde was necessarily an introvert, but I've noticed a lot of his witticisms are very apropos of being an introvert. It's very interesting.
Oh, his observations of in social situations and these characters. You know, for somebody who likes to observe people, it's just wonderful.
thank you so much for sharing with us and for sharing such wonderful information and insights, especially I love the piece about the conversation conundrum because that comes up so often. And so clearly we only touched on, I know, a little bit of what you've got to share in that chapter. So how can people get a hold of their own copy of the second edition of Introvert Power and learn more about you?
Yes, well, Introvert Power is hitting the bookstores. I understand it's available at Barnes & Noble stores, and my independent is just getting it in probably today. And so I think you'll find it in your bookstore, and if you don't, ask for it. And online, it is available and ready to order at your favorite outlet.
Right.
Yes, and as far as me, you can find me there's a great interaction going on and my Facebook Introvert Power page. It's just a really nice community that gathers there. And also you can find me at my website, which is laurihelgo.com or introvertpower.com.
And do you tweet?
I do tweet, yes. And I took off on the flaneur idea, so it's L-A flaneur. I couldn't get the whole word in, but if you look for Lori Helgo, you'll find me.
Okay, perfect, perfect. Well, thank you so much, and again, congratulations. The book is beautiful, the new content is wonderful, and it's such a wonderful addition to the continuing conversation about introverts and our journey towards loving ourselves and self-acceptance and feeling powerful. So thank you.
Yes. Well, thank you so much, Beth. And thanks for your part in fostering the conversation. You have really done so much to gather introverts together in this nice, wonderfully quiet way.
Yeah. Oh, thank you.
On the
thank
internet.
You. Yeah. In our very introvert style is how I like to call it. So, well, thank you.
Thank you, Beth.
As much as Lori shared with us today, there's a lot more to be enjoyed in the new edition of her book. Lori's writing style is conversational and engaging, and she makes her points through a beautiful balance of personal stories and very thorough research. It's a fabulous addition to the introvert literature, and I highly recommend it. Thank you for listening today. If you want to learn more about my coaching, speaking, and training services, you can find me online at www.theintrovertentrepreneur.com. And when you go into Amazon to order your own copy of Introvert Power, I hope you'll consider adding a copy of my first book, Insight, Reflections on the Gifts of Being an Introvert, to your cart. Until we meet again, remember that success is an inside job.